we have been taken up to the point where it has been concluded that every effort is motivated by happiness, which is not merely a practical fact but also a psychological truth. But the mere recognition of the presupposition of happiness behind every kind of activity does not solve the problem of happiness, its location, its whereabouts, and the means of its acquisition. Normally, in our workaday world, we are accustomed to think that happiness is an achievement by means of an effort in the direction of an object which is regarded as the location of happiness. It is strange, no doubt, that different subjects endeavoring in the direction of happiness have different objects where happiness is supposed to be lodged. It does not mean that the same object is the house or the abode of the happiness of everyone, every perceiving subject. This is the irony of the whole affair, that it seems to be present in every object, inasmuch as every object is the target of the approach of some subject or the other in this world. Though it is true that no particular object can attract the recognition of all subjects at the same time, this is the reason behind a doubt that can arise in the mind as to where happiness lies. Is it in me or is it in somebody else? If it is in the mind of the subject merely, as it is sometimes made out by psychologists, then there would be no point in the mind moving towards an object of sense for the acquisition of pleasure. The very fact that the mind is not satisfied with its own self and feels an obligation to move towards something outside should be an indication enough that something is lacking in the mind itself. And this lacuna in the mind is the cause for the movement of the mind towards something outside for the purpose of the search of that which it is not able to discover in its own self. So there seems to be a flaw in the doctrine that the mind alone is the source of all happiness, because this doctrine is refuted by the very activity of the mind every day, which move towards things other than its own self, the objects outside in the world around us. But the other doctrine, that the world is the source of happiness, also seems to be refuted by a deeper analysis, that no object seems to be capable of attracting the attention of everyone at the same time, nor even one and the same subject for all times. So there seems to be some mystery behind even the assumption of the presence of happiness in the objects outside. But it must be somewhere, it cannot be neither here nor there, because the whole world of perceptual activity is a collaboration of the subject and the object. And therefore it has to be either in this way or that way. By mere empirical analysis, it is difficult to find out where happiness lies, because a mathematical or an arithmetical analysis of the situation will lead us merely to the analysis of the mind inside and the objects outside. There is nothing else for us to discover in this world. But we find that we cannot discover the happiness in the mind, nor can we discover it in the objects of sense. So the curious question is, where is happiness? A very stimulating answer comes to this question from the great master Sanat Kumara. It is not in the mind, it is not in the object, taken independently by themselves. Happiness cannot be bifurcated as a property of some particular finite thing in creation. If it is regarded as a property of the mind, it becomes a finite content. If it is regarded as a property of an object of sense, again it is finite in its nature. Even if you regard the abode of happiness as a blend of the object and the subject in a finite manner, even then the joint action of two finites cannot amount to more than the finite. Two finites coming together cannot create anything more than a finite, maybe a little larger magnitude physically or spatially may be recognized in the joint activity of the subject and the object, but the finitude in the product of these two does not cease. But happiness cannot be regarded as finite ultimately, because we do not seek a finite pleasure in this world. No one asks for limited happiness. There seems to be some peculiar character in happiness which defies definition in terms of finitude. It is impossible for a person to be satisfied with finite happiness, though logically it cannot be defined as to how it can be infinite. The impulse from within which seeks for happiness is an answer to this question. It answers its own question by saying that I am not satisfied with any amount of happiness which is bounded by finitude of any kind. So it is not in the finite object. It is not in the finite subject. Merely because of the fact the finite container cannot afford to lodge within itself that which exceeds the limit of finitude. So Sanat Kumara says, my dear Narada, happiness is not anywhere and yet it is everywhere. It is in a completeness of being that you can find happiness. It is not in any kind of accumulation of particulars that happiness can be found. It is not in an aggregate of finitudes that happiness can be discovered. The finitude of a particular situation does not get obviated merely because of the aggregate of the finitudes. Even millions and millions of finite objects put together do not cease to be finite in the end. The finitude which is the character of things, persists even in an aggregate of finitudes. Even the whole world put together is finite. It cannot be regarded as infinite because it is limited by space, limited by time, and limited by the very presence of inner discrepancy within its own self. So what is there which is not finite in this world? Then where is happiness? Not in anything that can be conceived by the mind or perceived by the senses. Happiness cannot be in anything in this world because everything in this world is finite. The totality of objects also cannot be regarded as complete. But there is something which can be regarded as complete, whose definition of course defies ordinary mental cognition and assumption. That is the spiritual fullness, which philosophers call the Absolute. And followers of religion call God. psychologists call the Supreme Spirit, the great reality that is behind all finitudes, that alone can be regarded as complete in itself, because that alone is independent of any kind of contact with the finitudes. That infinitude is the source of happiness, whose reflection in some manner or other in the finite objects of sense becomes responsible for our belief that happiness is in the objects outside. Yo vai bhuma tat sukham. Happiness is plenum. Happiness is completeness. Happiness is the totality. Happiness is in the absolute. The term bhuma used in this Upanishad is a novel word of its own kind, which cannot be easily translated. It has a pregnant significance within itself, which implies absoluteness in quantity as well as in quality, and uncontaminated character by externality, and permanency of every type, immortality, infinity, eternity. All these ideas are embedded in the very concept of what the Upanishad calls bhuma. Well, we can translate it in no other way than to call it the absolute being. The Brahman of the Upanishads is the same as the bhuma mentioned here. That alone is happiness. If that is happiness, why is it that we feel happiness in objects of sense? There must be some mystery behind the search for happiness in the objects of the world. If it is true that they do not contain happiness, nalpe sukham asti, yo vai bhuma tat sukham. The finite things do not contain happiness, says the Sanat Kumara master. If finite objects do not contain happiness and it is only in the absolute, what is the reason for the search for happiness in objects of sense and the discovery of this happiness in the objects of sense? If it is absolutely impossible to discover it in objects, no person will go towards any object of sense. The reason is that the presence of this bhuma is felt in every object in some mysterious manner. The existence aspect of the object, as they say, is the reason behind the discovery of happiness in the objects, which are nothing but names and forms ultimately. There is something in the objects which is capable of indicating that behind them is this reservoir of happiness. The indication is due to their coming in contact with the minds of the subjects and creating a situation of apparent completeness. Wherever there is a sensation of completeness, there is happiness. This completeness may be artificially brought about, an apparently conceived totality and not a real one, or it may be a true one. Whatever it be, a mere semblance of the experience of this completeness becomes the source of the experience of happiness. The union, in whatsoever a manner that be, between the seeking subject and the object sought for, creates in the mind perceiving and cognizing and searching a sensation of having achieved its purpose. and the sensation attended with a sort of consciousness of having achieved one's purpose brings about a stimulation within, which is characterized by a feeling of completeness. A sensation of completeness is introduced into the mind the moment the feeling that something asked for has already been obtained. It is capable of lasting only for a fraction of a moment, because the mind cannot be satisfied with the idea that its purpose has been fulfilled merely because of contact with an object. It is induced into a false notion that the purpose has been served by a momentary contact of the subject with the object. But it is momentary merely because of the fact that at once the mind realizes that a mistake has been committed, unconsciously as it were, and it withdraws itself from this contact and hibernates itself into its own cocoon, searches for another source of happiness and finds itself in a state of misery at once in one moment. So every experience of happiness in this world is passing, fleeting, transient, momentary, of the character of a moment. It cannot last for 5 minutes. No one has experienced happiness for 5 minutes continuously, because of the fact there is anxiety within. And these anxieties are brought about by suspicions arising in the mind together with the experience of this contact of itself with the object. The suspicions brought about by the recognition that contact is not actual union, because the union of the subject with the object is different from contact physically or even psychologically. So there is a flaw in every type of union. Samyoga viprayoga antaha. Every coming together ends in a separation, whatever that be, either in this world or in the other world. This is the reason why there is an apparent happiness in this world, in our coming in contact with things of the world. But yet, even this so-called apparent momentary happiness is due to an introduction of the presence of this bhuma in that flash of a moment of experience, which is caused by the psychological cessation of search for objects of sense because of the feeling of a sense of completeness, brought about again by the feeling that one's purpose has been served. So the point remains unaffected. It is completeness of being that is the source of happiness. But where is this completeness of being? Not in the objects of sense, not in the union of one and two, or in the union of many together. Social union is no union at all, because they are coming together in a physical or psychological or social sense, no doubt, but they are not unions. Union is a real blend into a single being. Whatever be the attempt of subjects in their coming in contact with objects, they never become one being. You have never seen two persons becoming one, or two things becoming one, or a society of people merging into a single personality. Such a thing has never been heard, and nor is it practicable. But until that is practicable, happiness also is not practicable. So the search for happiness in this world is a search for the will of the wisp. It is a search for the phantasmagoria of the concoction of one's own mind. Not in the finite is happiness to be found. Nalpe sukham asti. Yo vai bhuma tat sukham. The absolute fullness alone is bliss. Bhumai va sukham. So I reiterate, Narada, this is the truth. The total union of being as such, which I regard as bhuma, I call as bhuma, that is the real bliss. bhumatveva vijijnasitavyaha. But you must know what fullness is. Though I say that bhuma, the fullness, is bliss, how can you enter into this bhuma unless you know what bhuma is? Bhumanam bhagavo vijijnasaiti, great master, please tell me what this bhuma is. Please introduce me into this great mystery of being you call bhuma. What is bhuma? What is fullness? What is completeness? If it is not to be found in the union of things in this world, where else can I find it? Narada is told now by Sanat Kumara, yatra nanyat pasyati, nanyat shrunoti, nanyat vijanati sa bhuma, atha yatra anyat pasyati, anyat shrunoti, anyat vijanati tadalpam. Do you want to know what completeness is? And do you want to know what finitude is? Here is the definition. Where one sees nothing except one's own self. Where one hears nothing except one's own self. Where one understands nothing except one's own self. That is Bhuma, the Absolute. Where one sees something outside oneself. Where one hears something outside oneself. Where one understands or thinks something outside oneself. That is the finite. Here no happiness can be found. So here is the whole matter clinched in a single sentence. What is fullness and what is not fullness? Yo vai bhuma tadamritam. What you call the immortal is the bhuma alone. And what you call the mortal or the perishable, it is the finite, where you see something external to you. Yo vai bhuma tadamritam yan yadalpam tanmartyam sa bhagavah kasmin pratishthita. Great master, where is this bhuma situated? Which place? Sve mahimni yadivana mahimniti. You ask me where it is situated. This great, eternal, all presence. You ask me where it is situated. It is situated in its own glory. Well, or perhaps it has no situation at all. It cannot be that it is located in something else, it is dependent on something else, that it has something else as its support, as we have some other supports in this world. How can the all being be supported by something else? It is the support of all things. What is the question that you are putting to me? Its support is its own self. Or rather I say, it has no support, it is the support of all. What do you mean by support? What is this question? Where it is located? Where it is situated? You have got some wrong notion in your mind, Narada, because you are thinking in terms of objects in this world. People in this world regard cattle and horses as greatness. For instance, a man is very rich, well supported and sustained. If he has plenty of cattle, plenty of horses, if he has elephants, if he has gold, if he has plenty of servants, attendants, a palatial building and vast property and a beautiful house to live in, this is called a well-to-do life in this world. This is called good support. This is called sustenance. Not so is this supported. It does not require any of these things for its support. Its being is not dependent on anything that is of the nature of support in this world. यो गो अश्वमिहा महिमेत्या चष्टते हस्ति हिरण्यम दासभार्यम क्षेत्राणि आयतनानि नाहमेव ब्रवीमि. I am not speaking of the absolute in this sense as you are thinking in your mind that it requires something else to lean upon. ब्रवीमीति होवाच अन्यो ह्यन्यस्मिन् प्रतिष्ठित इति. The relativity of things is the support of things in this world. Everything hangs on something else in this world. I'll hang on you, you hang on me. That is how we live in this world. But no such hanging is possible here. It is self-sufficient, self-supported, self-complete, self-existent. It is not relative being, it is absolute being. Well, everything in this world is relative in the sense that everything is supported by something else. Everything is defined by something else. Everything is determined by the existence of something else. Not in this sense does the absolute exist. It is absolutely independent, therefore it is non-relative in every sense of the term. It is everywhere. It is difficult to say where it is, because the question where it is implies the existence of space. Your question itself is unfounded and unwarranted. Why do you say where it is as if it is in space? But if you want to tell me where it is, I say it is in every nook and corner, in every pinpoint of space. There is nothing where it is not. There is no space which it does not occupy. Sa eva adhastat. If you go down below, you will find it. Sa uparishtat. If you go above, you will find it there. Sa paschat. If you go behind you, you will find it there also. Sa purastat, if you go in front of you, it is there. Sa dakshinada, to the right of you, it is there. Sa uttarada, to the right, left of you, it is there. Sa e vedam sarvam, Narada, what can I tell you? Whole thing is filled by it. It is not merely filling everything, it is all things. All these things that you see with your eyes are nothing but configurations of its own being. Are you satisfied? Athat ahankara adisha. Now, a doubt may arise in the minds of people. It is there. Grammatically, the word it implies third person. Is it a third person other than me? No. It is the subject thinking such. The subject that imagines that it is perhaps a third person also is included in it. So, athat ahankara desha, the thinking subject also is that very thing which we refer to as the bhuma, not merely that as the transcendent presence. Ahankara desha, aham eva adhastad, aham uparishtad, aham paschad, aham purastad, aham dakshinad, aham uttarad, aham evedam sarvam. Just as you can say, it is all things, it is here, it is there, it is everywhere, the subject also can be said to be everywhere, I, here, there, everywhere. But here again a doubt may arise, what is this I, this individual I, this ego? Is it an ego perceiver? Is this the empirical subject asserting itself as the all? No, the Atman in the subject is that which is identical with the Bhuma, that is cosmic. So a distinction is to be drawn between the individual subject and the subjectness universally present behind the individualities. That is called the Atman. So it is not the Jiva that is identified with the Brahman here, but the Atman. As they say, the space within a vessel is identical with the space in the universe outside. There is no distinction between a pot space or a glass space and the space outside, because they are only imaginary distinction that we create. Really, no such thing exists as internal space or outer space. So is this identity of the Atman with the Bhuma. So to obviate any kind of doubt as to whether it is the Ahankara or the individual subject, the subject that is implied here, the teacher says, Athata Atma Desha, Atmi Vadhastat, Atma Uparishtat, Atma Paschat, Atma Purastat, Atma Dakshinadaha, Atma Uttaradaha, Atma Vedam Sarvam. The universal is also the Atman in all things. It is the essential subject in everything. So that which is cosmically present as the total object is also the total subject. It is the subject and the object at one stroke in a universal sense. This is what I mean by Bhuma. Here is happiness, nowhere else. What else can be said? Everything has been said, whatever is required. Sava esha evam pashyan evam manvana evam vijanan atmaratiratma kridatma mituna atmananda saswarad bhavati tasya sarveshu lokeshu kamacharo bhavati. Narada, what can I tell you? One who has such realization or knowledge as this that I have mentioned to you just now. One who can see things in this manner, think in this manner, or understand in this manner, as I have expounded just now, such a person is the most happy person conceivable. Such a person is delighted within one's own self. Such a person plays with one's own self. Such a person enjoys one's own self. Such a person is rooted in the bliss of one's own self. Now, what is this one's own self? Should not create any doubt in the mind, because already it has been told us what the self is. It is not myself, it is not yourself, it is not the bodily self, it is not the individual self, it is the universal being, the all being, the all presence, Bhuma. That is what is called the self. And when we say the person enjoys himself, it is the absolute that is enjoying itself. That is what we are speaking about, and not Mr. So-and-so, not this person or that person. This is a very great distinction that you have to draw when you try to understand these passages of a highly mystical character. A person of this nature, endowed with this knowledge, acquiring this realization, becomes a master of himself, which means to say a master of all things. Self-mastery is mastery of the universe. Saha swarad bhavati, he becomes self-emperor, self-king, ruling over the self. To rule over the self is to rule over everything that has a self within itself. And as the self is everywhere, it is a rule over everything. It is cosmic rulership that is intended by saying self-kingship or Atma-swarajya. Atma-swarajya mentioned here is universal lordship. It is the experience of God being. Such is the experience that is bestowed upon this blessed soul who has entered into the bosom of this knowledge, this realization, this experience. Sasvarad bhavati tasya sarveshu lokeshu kamacharo bhavati. This person can enter into every realm at any moment. Just as you can move from one room to another room of your house without any kind of impediment or obstruction, because you are a free master of your own house, so does this soul, acquiring this knowledge, enter into every plane of existence. Every realm of being becomes a free passage to this great one who has acquired this knowledge. He becomes possessed of cosmic freedom. But what about those people who do not have this knowledge? They are subjected by other people, controlled by others. They are limited people. It is they that take rebirth by pressure of circumstances. Atha ye anyatha ataha viduhu anya rajanaha. Whoever imagines that there are things outside one's own self naturally is controlled by those things which are outside oneself. If you are living in a world of externalities, those externals shall compel you to subjection to their own law and mandate. this cannot be escaped. Anya Rajanaha, they are not self-kings but other kings, which means to say kings are outside them, they themselves are not, they are subjects. Chaya Loka Bhavanti, their worlds are perishable. Whatever they get in this world is mere dust and ashes. They only reap sorrow in this world. They cannot get happiness because they live in a world of finitude. Teshu Sarveshu Lokeshu Akamacharo Bhavati, they cannot have free entry into worlds. They are limited to the circle of their own experience. These are the jivas, these are the bound souls, these are those bereft of this great knowledge we are speaking of.
Tasya va etasya evam pasyataha, evam manvanasya, evam vijanataha, atmataha prana, atmataha asha, atmataha smaraha, atmataha akashaha, atmataha dejaha, atmataha apaha, आत्मतः आविर्भाव तिरोभावौ आत्मतः अन्नम आत्मतः बलम आत्मतः विज्ञानम आत्मतः ध्यानम आत्मतः चित्तम आत्मतः संकल्पः आत्मतः मनः आत्मतः वाक आत्मतो नाम आत्मतो मंत्रः आत्मतः कर्माणि आत्मतः एव इदं सर्वम्.
To such a blessed one, everything comes, rises from one's own self. You need not go hither and thither in search of things if you have this knowledge. You do not go to things, things come to you. The ocean does not go to the rivers, the river comes to the ocean. Whoever is endowed with this great experience, this knowledge, this possession of wisdom, to such a person, everything that has been mentioned in the gradation of the categories earlier, right from name onwards up to this place where we are discussing now, everything arises automatically from the self, because the supreme cause contains within itself everything else mentioned as its own effects. All these worlds, space, time, and the five elements, all created beings, everything that we have been studying up to this time in the various stages of development of thought, all these need not be approached independently or individually for our satisfaction. They all come simultaneously rising from one's own self. Again, to reiterate, the true self, the Bhuma, because that self being all contains all, and therefore all things come to that person who ceases to be a person anymore. He is only a lodgment, apparently looking like a person in this world, a Jivan Mukta Purusha as they call him, but really a repository of the absoluteness that he has realized. Idam Sarvam, everything comes to him, everything flows from his own being, because he himself is the all.
Tadesha Shloko Bhavati. न पश्यो मृत्युं पश्यति न रोगं नो तु दुःखतां सर्वं अपश्यः पश्यति सर्वमाप्नोति सर्वशः स एकधा भवति त्रिधा भवति पञ्चधा सप्तधा नवधा चैव पुनश्च एकादशः स्मृतः शतं च दश च एकश्च सहस्राणि च विंशतिः आहारशुद्धौ सत्त्वशुद्धिः सत्त्वशुद्धौ ध्रुवा स्मृति स्मृतिलम्भे सर्वग्रन्थीनां विप्रमोक्षः तस्मै मृदितकषायाय तमसः पारं दर्शयति भगवान् सनत्कुमारः तं स्कन्द इत्याचक्षते तं स्कन्द इत्याचक्षते. द चाप्टर् इस् कन्क्लूडेड्. द भूमविद्या इस् एक्स्पौण्डेड्. One who has this realization is free from every kind of affliction.
physical, mental or otherwise. No death, no transmigration, no sorrow, no grief, no adhibhautika, adhyatmika, adhidevika, tapa can afflict this person. Becoming all, this person sees the all. Sees the all, having known the all. Knows the all because he is the all. Sarva mapunovati sarvashah. Everything is attained at one stroke, not in succession as we hear in this world do. In every manner everything comes. Sarva mapunovati sarvashah. Things come to us in certain ways, not in every way. And all things do not come to us at the same time. Certain things come to us, not all things. And certain things come to us at some time, not all times. And even at some time, not in every way, but in only certain manners. But here it is that everything comes at all times in every way. This is the great result that follows from this realization. Sarva mapunoti sarvasha. In every manner of manifestation, in every possible pattern of existence or being, things flow into this person because this person is inclusive of every pattern of being, every plane of existence, every realm conceivable. That is the meaning of sarva mapunoti sarvasha. The Upanishad reiterates this very same meaning by saying that he becomes all, 1, 2, 3, 4, million-fold, 1,000-fold, whatever you can think of. All things are contained in this single experience, which is made out by this exclamation of the Upanishad. It is one-fold, it is two-fold, it is three-fold, it is five-fold, it is seven-fold, it is nine-fold, it is 100-fold, it is 1,000-fold, it is 1,000,000-fold, as wide as this creation itself. So is the glory of this creation. The sun has one ray or seven rays or 1,000,000 rays, as you may call. Everything, of course, interpreters of the Upanishad try to find a specific intention behind these words. It is one soul or threefold, adhyatmika, adhibhautika, adhidevika, or it is fivefold as the senses can catch, or sevenfold as the categories of being, or ninefold as the internal organs, or it is 11-fold as some of the organs left out, and 100-fold, including many other categories, hundreds and thousands of fold. All these things are comprehended within this single being. The manifoldness mentioned here is merely a categorizing of this singleness of being through the channels of perception and experience in various manifestations, human, celestial, subhuman, etc., etc. As is the type of nature of the incarnation, so is the nature of perception and experience. So all these categories are subsumed under this single being. What you call the inanimate world, what you call the vegetable kingdom, what you call the animal world, what you call the human level, what you call superior levels of celestials, even up to Brahmaloka, all these are comprehended within this single reality to which there is no levels of being. It has no inanimate category there. It has no distinction of subject and object. It is the seer as well as the seen. This knowledge comes if your effort is properly directed. It does not suddenly drop from the skies, or like a fruit that is coming from the branch of a tree falling down. Great effort is needed to acquire this knowledge.
Ahara Shuddho Sattva Shuddhi.
Purity of thought is a consequence of purity of diet. Here, some people are of opinion that you must take pure food, sattvic diet, as it is usually told us. But other thinkers opine us that if you think wrongly and see evil things or hear evil things and touch evil things but eat good things like cow's milk, etc., that is not going to help you. So, Shankaracharya particularly is of opinion that it is an exhortation to receive pure things through every sense organ, including the mind. You must see purity, hear purity, touch purity, and think purity, understand purity. What is purity? Purity is that which is compatible with the nature of the Absolute. That is called purity. Anything that is incompatible is not purity. This is a difficult subject to explain now. We shall touch upon it a little further. What is that which is compatible with the nature of the Absolute and what is not? That which is in consonance in nature with the nature of the Absolute, that is pure. So whenever you cognize a thing, perceive a thing, that thing should be from the point of view of your cognition or perception capable of being harmonized with the Absolute. It should not be incompatible in nature. That thing is purity. And when that purity arises in the mind, there is that capacity of concentration of mind which retains the consciousness of the Bhuma. That is the perpetual retention of memory or smriti. You can never forget the being of the Absolute in your own being. Then comes perpetual retention of this consciousness. Then all the knots of the heart get broken. Smritilambhe sarvagranthinam vipramocha. The granthis or the knots of the heart are avidya, kama, karma, as they usually call them. Ignorance, desireful movement of the mind, and activity towards the fulfillment of desires, these are the knots of the heart. Sometimes they are called Brahma Granthi, Vishnu Granthi, Rudra Granthi, all meaning one and the same thing. The ties of the mind, the psychological knots to which we are tethered to earthly experience, these are the Granthis mentioned. They break immediately and you enter into the ocean of being. Sarva Granthinam Viparamoksha. Thus did Sanat Kumara, the great master, instruct Narada, the great disciple, who was free from all impurity of every kind, a fit disciple, being instructed by an exceptionally great master. Tasmai mridita kashayaya tamasah param darasheti Bhagavan Sanat Kumara. Bhagavan Sanat Kumara, the great master, initiates Narada into this great mystery of Supreme Being. And he takes this disciple across the ocean of sorrow. This Sanat Kumara, says the Upanishad, is called Skanda. Tagum Skanda ityachachate, Tagum Skanda ityachachate. Sanat Kumara is called Skanda because he has crossed or leaped over phenomenal existence. That is one interpretation of the word Skanda. He has jumped across the ocean of sorrow. Tamasah Param. And there is also a story that Sanat Kumara himself was born as Skanda or Kartikeya, the second son of Lord Shiva, for the purpose of fulfilling a great purpose of the gods, as you will read from the Puranas and the epics. It is believed that Sanat Kumara took birth as Kartikeya. There is a story behind it in the Puranas. So whatever it be, either you take him as the divinity that took birth as Skanda in the next incarnation, or one who has crossed the ocean of sorrow, jumped into the absolute, across the phenomenality of life. To such a person, he is our obeisance, he is Kanda, he has reached the Absolute, and he takes us all to the Absolute.
Hari Om Tat Sat.